This is the tax update for March 24, 2008. This week, upon further review, self-employment tax issues. The Tax Update podcast and Center for Tax Professionals is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Back in early July 2005, I started experimenting with these podcasts, driven by the fact that just recently Apple had placed on the iTunes Music Store a section for podcasts and distributing these audio files that had been created by individuals and that Apple was going to allow to be downloaded onto computers and downloaded onto the iPods automatically. The second podcast I posted dealt with self-employment taxation and LLCs that was based on a presentation I'd given at the Phoenix Tax Workshop that summer. I want to go back now and do a more complete review of the issue and bring the matter a little bit up to date and discuss some of the issues and where we stand today. This is coming up here a little less than 3 years later, looking back at what still exists in the area of self-employment taxes, LLC members, and this whole area. As well, last month we dealt with self-employment tax in the new Section 761 Qualified Joint Ventures that was based on a discussion at January Tax Talk Today webcast podcast from the IRS and the Form 1065 instructions that describe this matter as well. In the most recent Tax Talk Today, it was noted in passing that the matter was clarified, shall we say, in a revised transcript of that January program. Now, much like the Schedule D instruction clarification you may remember previously that we had a year ago, the term clarification to the IRS usually means forget what we just said and let's start over. That's what it means this time, too. In the materials for this podcast that are available on the ezollers.libsyn.com website, go there, you'll find the link to the materials for this podcast, which you probably should be downloading. In any event, it gives you some of the notes about what's going on and some of the sources. I have the link to the actual clarification that's in the news section of Tax Notes Today. We're going to discuss that clarification as well in this podcast dealing with self-employment taxes. Now, the clarification date was March 7th in its file properties, according to the PDF file that I read for the revised transcript. So it appears the revelation came to the IRS a bit after the actual broadcast of Tax Notes Today, of the Tax Talk Today, I should say, webcast. And it appears that they may have realized that what they were saying and what the instructions were saying may have opened up opportunities, shall we say, for tax planning with self-employment tax that the IRS wasn't terribly happy about. So now upon further review, they have decided it doesn't quite work the way we told you it did. Back, though, to the LLC members and self-employment tax generally. A major area of confusion exists among practitioners and clients on the proper treatment of LLC members where the self-employment tax is concerned. This confusion exists both due to the fact that when Section 1402A13 of the Code, which deals with the exemption from self-employment tax for limited partners, was added to the Code, there was no such thing as a limited liability company out there, nor would such a thing exist for a couple of decades. And the fact that the IRS's 1997 proposed regulations to clarify this matter became very politically controversial, that resulted in a regulatory paralysis that has stayed in place for the past 11 years. To date, those regs still exist in proposed status, neither going final nor being withdrawn. Let's review quickly the general rules for self-employment tax. Again, the code section that governs self-employment tax, as always, is Section 1402. And under Section 1402A, the general rule is a partner is subject to self-employment tax on their distributive share, whether or not distributive, income or loss, described in Section 702A8 from any trade or business carried on by the partnership of which he is a member. Now, that's regardless of the level of action or inaction of the partner himself. Unlike an individual, which is the first half of that clause, where we test whether the individual is carrying on a trade or business, for a partnership, again using entity-level taxation theory, we look to whether the partnership carries on a trade or business, and if it does, then the taint of self-employment tax flows through to the partner on any of the business income that would otherwise be subject to self-employment tax. An exception to this general rule exists at 1402A13, and that provides for limited partners, there shall be excluded from the distributive share of any item of income or loss of a limited partner as such, other than guaranteed payments described in Section 707C to that partner for services actually rendered to or on behalf of the partnership, to the extent that those payments are established to be in the nature of remuneration for those services. Now, some taxpayers have attempted to argue that we should just look at the level of activity they have incurred in the partnership, and that should allow them to make use of the exclusion from self-employment tax, self-employment income taxation. Taxpayers who have attempted to argue that their limited activity in a partnership has prevented them from being subject to SE tax haven't fared well. For one example of many in such a case that has happened over the years that has dealt with Section 1402A13 in the law, we look at the case of Norwood versus Commissioner. Now, Mr. Norwood was a yacht salesman who, while he owned a significant portion of a partnership, actually did very little work. Now, he had founded the partnership, he had been very active, but he had moved out of that, gone full-time, had been a yacht salesman. At this point, he did very little work. In fact, the court indicated that he had done about 40 hours or 41 hours worth of work the particular year in question. The court ruled that, in fact, he had to pick that up as self-employment income regardless of the fact that he did nothing. That was because that is the test under 1402A, is not the question of whether Mr. Norwood did anything, but was he a partner? Did the partnership carry on a trade or business? It did. And did he qualify for any of the exceptions? The court ruled he did not. Only obvious exception would have been A13. This was true despite the fact the court said, essentially, first issue, Mr. Norwood said, but I am passive under Section 469. And it was passive. His hours were well below the amounts required that would have made him into an active participant in the trade or business. His level of activity was well below the level that you could argue made him active. For Section 469, this was passive income. Did that exclude him from self-employment tax? No, the court indicates. Section 469 is irrelevant in determining self-employment taxation. The court noted that the passive activity rules under Section 469 have no application in this case. More ominously, though, for those of us looking at LLCs and this entity that didn't exist when 1402A13 was first created, was that in this 2000 case, the court noted that for self-employment tax, the court in dicta bluntly stated that a limited partnership must be created in the form prescribed by state law in order to get the benefit of Section 1402A13. That creates a very problematic set of cases for LLCs. Why? LLCs aren't limited partnerships under state partnership law. For instance, in California, limited partnerships are defined in Title II of the California Corporations Code, the general partnerships title, while limited liability companies are defined and established via Title 2.5 of the Corporations Code. That is, they are different things legally. However, an LLC is treated as a partnership under check-the-box regulations is a partnership for all purposes under the IRC. Note that the check-the-box regulations say nothing about, is that going to be a limited partnership under 1402A13? It's quiet on the matter. It doesn't say. It just says it'll be a partnership. Remember, our default treatment under 1402A is partners pay self-employment tax on the trade or business income of the partnership. Therefore, if in order to be a limited partnership, we believe the Norwood theory that in fact it has to be a state law limited partnership, that suggests an answer for LLC members that is rather nasty and not one any of us are going to like, nor frankly not one of, that most of us would actually end up following. But nevertheless, under the pure case law side of it, there's not going to be a lot of comfort for you in attempting to exclude that income from self-employment tax. Now, part of the issue was the regime was enacted to solve a very different problem than what we face today. Why is 1402A13 there? That history is discussed fairly well by William and Burgess Raby in their article back from 2000 of Partners, LLC Members, and SE Tax. And in that area, they noted, quote, if a taxpayer was over age 50 but not covered by Social Security, obtaining 40 quarters of coverage by becoming a limited partner was a way of obtaining fully insured status under the Social Security rules, and thus of purchasing Social Security benefits worth a great deal more than the modest self-employment tax that would be paid. Back when these rules were first put in place, back when 1402A13 first came in the code. Now, since all that happened, things have changed. Social Security rates have gone up. We now tax Social Security income of the well-to-do. Basically, 85% of that ends up coming into income. These days, I don't know about you, but I have very few clients coming in the door trying to desperately pay FICA and self-employment tax. That simply isn't the normal case. The issue today is more clients now believe that that's not such a great deal any longer, and they would prefer to not pay Social Security and self-employment tax. As well, we have these LLCs that never were factored into the mix. Frankly, had they existed back when 1402A13 was put into law, it's very likely Congress would have found some ways to wrap them into this mix as well, since they obviously could have been used for the same purpose limited partnerships are being used for, that is, to give somebody no real exposure to liability, but allow them to qualify for Social Security by investing in this partnership and being very passive. Norwood made it clear, you could have been totally passive and still paid self-employment tax. So it seems, had Congress known about such things or thought such things were coming into existence, they would have wrapped them up in 1402A13. But the problem is, they didn't. Now, that whole result didn't sit well with many, including those in the IRS, and that resulted in two sets of proposed regulations. In 1994, a set of proposed regulations came out that are now of historical interest because they've been withdrawn, but are of important historical interest because in 1994, the IRS first basically broached the idea of let's divorce the concept of limited partner under 1402A13 from state law limited partnership. That is, under the original 1994 proposed regulations, if the partnership could have been formed as a limited partnership under state law and the partner could have been a limited partner, then even though it was an LLC, the IRS was proposing we would treat those partners who could have been limited partners as limited partners and exempt them from self-employment tax. Anyone who could not have been a limited partner under state law, perhaps because their level of authority under the LLC operating agreement was too high and a limited partner could not have had that level of authority, those people would pay the self-employment tax. Now, those proposed regs only existed for a short time because in the interim, the IRS came up with check the box, which we now know is very important for us in dealing with LLCs. That's how we finally got to the point where it's pretty simple to decide an LLC was a partnership. Now, that redefined the whole concept of what is a partnership. Related to that, the IRS came out with proposed regulations on 1402A13. These regs were meant to kind of integrate in with the check the box theory. And the IRS again revisited saying, no, limited partner does not mean what state law says it means. You don't have to have somebody who is a limited partner under state law. Now, that both was good news we're going to discuss, because as we discussed, if we have to be a pure limited partner, that's not going to work well for us if we have an LLC. But these proposed regs said even if you were a limited partner under state law, that also is irrelevant. We're redefining limited partner totally for federal law purposes, for self-employment tax purposes, so you're not going to be able to use that to get out of self-employment tax either. That particular part of the regulations became a problem and an issue. As well, a number of service partnerships had arranged their life under the 94 proposed regulations to structure themselves in an entity that could have been a state law limited partnership, and under the 94 regulations had a number of their partners exempted from self-employment tax. Under the theory of the 94 regs, now 97 came down and changed those rules. For all those reasons, the regulations got known as the stealth tax regulations, and that created a controversy that has tainted this area for the past 11 years, resulting in a paralysis of nothing happening on the authority level, but us still having to file tax returns. Now, as with the check-the-box views of what is a partnership, the IRS proposed to junk the prior law theory, or the theory even relied upon even in Norwood, that what we had to worry about was state law defined what was a limited partner for Section 1402A13. Proposed regulation 1.1402A-2A provided a general set of tests for who would be a limited partner for purposes of 1402 only. That is, it made it clear this did not impact the analysis under Section 469 for passive activities. So this limited partnership definition would not impact the definition of what's a limited partnership under Section 469. First, a service partner in a service partnership could never be treated as a limited partner under these regulations, even if that person was recognized as a limited partner under the applicable state law. See proposed regulations 1.1402A-2H5. A service partnership is defined as a partnership substantially all the activity of which involve the performance of services in the field of health, law, engineering, architecture, accounting, actuarial science, or consulting. That list of items should sound very familiar because that's what we look at when we look at personal service corporations. A service partner in that service partnership is defined as a partner that provides more than de minimis amounts of services to or on behalf of that service partnership's trade or business. So we are somebody who is active in the trade or business and we perform those prohibited services. As such, we could never be a limited partner, even if under Arizona, California, New Mexico law, whatever it may be, we are functioning as a limited partner in a limited partnership. Similarly, even if under those state laws, though we have an LLC, we could have structured as a limited partnership and I could have been a limited partner given my rights, I still can't exclude that from income, even though under the 94 proposed regulations, I could have. Now, if we clear the service hurdle, then everyone else is presumed to be a limited partner. That's a nice presumption. However, if you fail one of three tests, you lose that presumption and become a general partner or somebody subject to SE tax. And I should clarify, I'll use the term general partner because that's how we usually discuss this. General partners are subject to self-employment tax. But the actual code never uses the term general partner. It's important to note, it says partners are subject to self-employment tax, limited partners are not. So it says, in the whole universe of things called partners, this subset called limited is who gets special treatment. So you're a limited partner unless you fail one of these tests. The partner has personal liability to the creditors of the partnerships by reason of being a partner. We still can guarantee debt, but if we have liability based on the mere fact that we've signed on the partnership agreement, that means, tough luck, you are subject to SE tax under these proposed regulations. If the partner has the authority under the laws of the jurisdiction where the partnership was formed to contract on behalf of the partnership, you are considered subject to SE tax. You're not a limited partner. Or if you participate in the trade or business for more than 500 hours during the partnership's tax year. Taking a number from the 469 regulations, we're looking now at the number of hours of service. If you work more than 500 hours, or that's approximately 10 hours a week in the service that the partnership performs, you're therefore, if you're or in the business of the partnership, you now become a person subject to self-employment tax. Now, if you fail only that last 500-hour test, you can still be treated as limited partner if two other hurdles are cleared. You can continue to be treated as a limited partner if limited partners who don't need the exception that we're talking about now to qualify own a substantial continuing interest in the specific class of partnership interest held by the 500-hour partner and the 500-hour partner's rights and obligations with regard to his interest are identical to those of other limited partners. In essence, that person can receive guaranteed payments. They'll still be subject to self-employment tax because, remember, guaranteed payments to a limited partner for their services are subject to SE tax. And you would presume if I'm going to be working 500 hours in this business and I have exactly the same rights to income and distributions of people doing no work whatsoever, I'd like to have a guaranteed payment. I'd like to have some extra money coming to me, probably as a guaranteed payment to compensate me for my services. If that's the case, then I can treat my guaranteed payments as self-employment income, but treat my basic pass-through income as not subject to self-employment tax. So, and the preamble to the proposed regulations make clear that's kind of the point of this. We can bifurcate, quote-unquote, the distributive share by disregarding guaranteed payments for services, in essence, but only if there are other partners who, not having to bifurcate their interests, that hold similar interests. So as long as we're compensated for our services, and presumably, again, with our negotiations, I'd make sure I got adequately compensated, as opposed to those people who simply are getting paid for doing, you know, who simply are getting their distribution and don't have to do anything in the business, then that's fine. We can bifurcate it. The preamble claims that that limits the exclusion of supplement income to amounts that are demonstrably returns on capital invested in the partnership, presumably since the other non-active members are getting the same allocation of income and their interests are more than nominal. Holders of multiple interests that failed any of those three tests we talked about, guaranteeing or being liable for the debt, being able to contract on behalf of the partnership, or working more than 500 hours, can also have the right to treat certain interests not subject to SE tax. But in order to do that, the holder must show that limited partners that don't need this exclusion to qualify own a substantial and continuing interest in a specific class of interest held by this particular partner who can't qualify, who has another interest that we're going to make subject to SE tax, and the rights and obligations with regard to this extra interest are identical to those of the other limited partners. That is, I have two classes of interest, Class A, Class B. Class B is the same as all the limited partners or our passive investors own. Class A is what I as a service partner get, or as the, not service partner, bad term, because that person's always subject, but as the person in the business, let's say, who's active in there. So I have my active interest and my passive interest, and I don't have to pay self-employment tax on my passive interest, but that requires that I have other passive investors who own a significant interest in the partnership. And that's under the proposed regulations. If I meet those exemptions, I have it. Now, note, these were proposed regulations. They were never made final, nor were they issued with that little blurb in a preamble that says we could rely on them prior to them going final. And going final proved to be a problem. The fact that those proposed regulations ignored all prior law and specifically would create self-employment tax liability for a partner that is legitimately a limited partner under state law raised a lot of controversy. In the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997, Congress reacted to the proposed regulations by including in the law Section 935 of the Act that provided no temporary final regulation with respect to a definition of a limited partner under Section 1402A13 of the Internal Revenue Code may be issued or made effective before July 1, 1998. Now, July 1, 1998 came and went, and Congress didn't extend the moratorium, nor did they modify the law to clarify the treatment of partners in a partnership or LLC members in a partnership. Similarly, the IRS never withdrew these proposed regs, and they haven't withdrawn them as of today. They've not replaced them with revised regulations, nor have they made the 1997 regulations final. They've not also indicated that we can rely. They've not made them into practitioners may rely or taxpayers may rely status. They haven't made them into temporary regulations. They just sit there. That gives us the limbo. Now, in recent years, interest has picked up in the area of self-employment tax and FICA Medicare taxation again. And the question of S corporation shareholders taking low salaries or no salaries to avoid FICA Medicare taxation in an S corporation setting and then taking their other income as distributions from the S corporation became somewhat popular. While the IRS has been relatively successful in the litigation arena, the perception is that far more S corporation shareholders are underpaying their share of payroll taxes. That, along with the financial issues facing Social Security and Medicare programs, has turned interest on the whole area of FICA, Medicare taxation, and self-employment taxes. Back in 2006, the chair and ranking minority members of the Senate Finance Committee, two individuals who switched positions the next January, but they're still the same two people, asked the staff of the Joint Committee on Taxation to report on potential sources of revenue, and reforms in the area of self-employment tax and Medicare and FICA taxation were a significant area they discussed. That committee's proposal would, in some form, reduce or eliminate the limited partner exception to the imposition of self-employment taxes. Either all partnership and S-corporation pass-through income related to a trade or business would be subject to self-employment taxation, or income from service partnerships and S-corporations would be made subject to self-employment tax, or perhaps some other method. But they indicated in their ruling that, hey, you know what, these rules are dated, they don't relate to what's happening right now, and we think the following revisions make sense. Now, no action has been taken since that 2006 report came out, although the ranking member and the committee chair, now having flipped positions, have indicated they thought the results were interesting and need to be considered. And the concept has been proposed multiple times and discussed multiple times since we've had changes in the law. Now, while the matter remains in flux, we still have to file tax returns. In addition, the heightened standards for taking positions on tax returns for tax preparers factor even more into making this a difficult proposition for those of us as preparers. The IRS has indicated informally on a number of occasions that if a preparer excludes income from treatment of supplement income for a partner that would have qualified for the exclusion of the proposed regulations, the IRS will not challenge that position. Thus, in the right cases, the proposed regulations could allow a practitioner to work with a client to ensure their interest in the LLC would qualify for partial or full exclusion for self-employment tax. Now note, this is still a case on proposed regulations that the IRS never officially indicated we could rely upon. Informally, they keep indicating it. But they do seem to provide enough support to get me to a comfort level, even up to the more likely than not comfort level. And if I have a conservative client that really just wants to make sure nothing goes wrong, if we can structure them to qualify under the proposed regs, that's probably the safest structure to go forward with and to report under. As well, if a taxpayer's legitimate limited partner, limited partnership formed under state law, limited partnership statute, it appears clear that the case law under 1402A13 makes that a clear case of an individual that is not subject to self-employment tax, at least until we get regulations that the IRS is willing to say you can rely upon, or that become temporary final regulations that redefine 1402A13. And even if the IRS tries that, there's going to be some question as to validity, but until they at least take the regs forward, it seems like the case law is clearly on the side of saying that a person who is a limited partner under state law, it does not have to include their share of income from the partnership except to the extent of guaranteed payments that represent guaranteed payments for services. Now, that would open up some issues for disguised guaranteed payments. Is this really a guaranteed payment or not? And there could be some discussion there if what we have is effectively like a guaranteed payment. But as long as they're not doing anything fancy, if they are a limited partner under a state limited partnership statute in a limited state limited partnership, it also appears to me that that has no trouble meeting the more likely than not standard. However, in other cases where a taxpayer doesn't qualify under one of these two ways of excluding from SE tax, but still thinks they should be able to exclude some or all of the income coming to them from the LLC from self-employment tax, a practitioner is going to have to take a look at the level of authority they believe to make something subject to or not subject to self-employment tax. Now, there's been a lot of discussion of locking the definition of limited partnership based on some test on how much activity the person has with the partnership. In essence, treating somebody like Mr. Norwood as a limited partner simply because he does very, very little with the partnership, that we should look at the level of activity. As well, there's also been discussion of integrating a theory like the reasonable compensation theory that we look at in S-corporation FICA arena to come up with an amount in the LLC subject to self-employment tax. If we have a reasonable level of compensation paid to the individual in a form of, let's say, guaranteed payment, then we can take the rest of it as not subject to self-employment tax. And remember, the proposed 1997 regulations had a theory that worked like that, though it had the requirement that we had to have other people with wholly limited partnership interest that were getting a distribution, in essence, to prove that this was truly return of capital, that that's how we locked down that it was legitimate the amounts being paid were for services. If there's no other such partners, but we're taking an amount for our services, and then everybody's taking a portion of it is not subject to it, that doesn't meet the 97 proposed regs, But we have to ask the question, does the IRS theory that 1402A13's definition of limited partner is kind of fungible and subject to this type of bifurcation, does that indicate that this may be a reasonable position to take? Open to question. Many taxpayers, you know, take use of a lot of options, and frankly, the IRS has not shown a lot of, let's say, reason or a lot of, they've really not shown that they're actively going after these positions, except for people that go for the, that, you know, fail the pigs versus hogs test and are going for full exclusion from self-employment tax. If somebody's not going 100%, it appears for the moment the IRS is taking a hands-off position. However, the problem is that we as practitioners have to worry about is that there's little authority supporting these alternative positions aside from the argument that the existence of the 94 and 97 proposed regulations indicates that the IRS believes it is reasonable to treat the 1402A13 definition as something that could be detached from a pure state law definition of what is a limited partner. And that some sort of test of what is a limited partner that doesn't deal with just literal state law testing is reasonable. Now, consideration is going to need to be given to the necessity to meet the disclosure requirements of Section 6694. If the taxpayer believes there is a reasonable basis for the position, which remember, we must have a reasonable basis even with disclosure, but we cannot get to the level of more likely than not or perhaps even our substantial authority level, and that might be difficult as well. My gut reaction is that any position other than the first two I described, I believe, is going to require the filing of the 8275 with the return to disclose that we have a position that does not meet substantial authority but meets reasonable basis. Now, you might have one you believe that has substantial authority. Maybe your position you believe has that doesn't go more likely than not. Then, subject to the discussion we had earlier, you'd have to notify the client of that distinction. If you do believe you meet more likely than not, then you could take one of those positions without disclosure. But frankly, I find it difficult to come to that level of assurance on these positions. Nevertheless, from a practical standpoint, is the IRS going to challenge it? Probably not, as long as you take a reasonable level of compensation. And ultimately, will we get to a point where that's the way the law goes? Well, we'll get to something, and I suspect that service partners are going to have a bad time when we get to an answer. And I suspect that there'll be some way, some intermediate range, that will be much like reasonable level of compensation for those people not in the tainted professions to bifurcate their interests. But that's all speculation at this point. As of right now, though, it doesn't appear the IRS is going to challenge it, so the question becomes, does the taxpayer want to go ahead and take the position? And then as a practitioner, what is the point about the 8275 filing that needs to go with the return, if it needs to go with the return? And that is your choice and the choice of the client. The question of the position to take is ultimately the client's choice. Now, the thing to be very careful of here is to assure that you don't make yourself the guarantor of the position. Because of the uncertainty here, clients need to understand their options. It's not serving the client to deny them options and say that you won't discuss these other issues. But it's also not serving the client to gloss over the fact that any position other than the ones that we feel meet the more likely than not test don't meet that test. That when we go for a position that we're interpreting and trying to kind of stretch out the view of what 1402A13 is, based upon a redefinition that's not the IRS's redefinition in the 97 proposed regs, we need to make it very clear to the client that that is a position that might not stand in court. That is a position that if challenged, they could end up owing tax and they could end up being penalized for that position. And they need to understand the risk they take and that you're not guaranteeing the position. You're telling them that it is a reasonable position, that you can support the position, but not that that position is never going to end up with them owing additional tax. If we don't do that, I have found clients tend to believe you did guarantee the position. And they tend to believe that when things go wrong, it's your fault that they're owing tax, because had they known, they would have followed the 97 proposed regs. They would have paid the self-employment tax, and obviously it's your foul-up. Even worse, they might decide we could have fit under the restrictions of the 97 proposed regs. And had you just told us about that, we'd have restructured ourselves, and then we wouldn't have owed the tax at all. So you're doubly to blame. Now let's go back to those qualified joint ventures and talk about the IRS clarification that came down just recently. Back on February 17th, I discussed the issue of self-employment tax, real estate ventures, and qualified joint ventures. The issue revolved around the addition to Section 1402A17 defining self-employment income. And it said, notwithstanding the preceding provisions of this subsection, each spouse's share of income or loss from a qualified joint venture shall be taken into account as provided in Section 761F in determining net earnings from self-employment of such spouse. Now, one of those preceding provisions is the one that says rental real estate is not to be treated as self-employment income. The January Tax Talk Today webcast podcast presented by the IRS discussed the provision. The discussion arose as practitioners noted the following interpretation of the provision as applied to rental real estate found on page 2 of the 2007 1065 instructions. By the way, instructions that still say this to this day if you download them from the IRS website. They say on page 2, and I quote, if you and your spouse make the election for your rental real estate business, you each must report your share of income and deductions on Schedule C or CEZ instead of Schedule E. Okay, so far no problem. But here's where the interesting part comes in. Although rental real estate income is generally not included in net earnings from self-employment, you and your spouse each must take into account your share of the income and deductions from the rental real estate business in figuring your net income from self-employment on Schedule SE. Well, now that's pretty clear, right? We got to go take, now we take it off Schedule E, we dump it on Schedule C, and that bottom line, income or loss, goes to the self-employment tax form. So that means if I had $100,000 of self-employment income from another trade or business I'm involved in, and I have rental real estate and we lose $10,000, then I can reduce my $100,000 of self-employment income by that $10,000 loss, right? Well, in the program transcript, the original program, a viewer asked for clarification. And that clarification was provided as follows per the transcript. And the IRS presenter responded, yeah, I'm not surprised somebody wanted clarification because that's a strange twist to it, but that is actually what the law says. It says that they will compile it with their 1040, and with that election, what would not be subject to SE tax flowing through a 1065 is subject to SE tax on the two Schedule Cs. In this month's Tax Note Today, Tax Talk Today presentation, International Tax Matters, which you might not have listened to if you didn't deal with the international tax arena, and you were kind of, and it's tax season, you're a little busy. A reference is made at the beginning of the program to the need that people should go back and check for an updated transcript for a clarification of the issue discussed in the January presentation. On page 19 of the revised January transcript, we now find the following clarification. While the profit or loss from rental real estate trade or business operated by a husband and wife be reported on two Schedule Cs if the spouses make the qualified joint venture election, neither making the qualified joint venture election nor reporting the profit or loss on two Schedule Cs converts amounts which are statutorily excluded from Self-Employment Contributions Act, SECA tax, otherwise what we know as a self-employment tax, into amounts subject to the self-employment tax. Similarly, simply electing to be treated as a qualified joint venture and thereby reporting the rental real estate joint venture profit or loss to Schedule Cs does not convert the income or loss from passive to non-passive. Or, to put it simply, forget what we said in the 1065 instructions about SE. As of the date I'm writing this, on March 20th, 2008, is the date I was recording this, which is now Saturday, March the 22nd, the IRS instructions for Form 1065 still contain the statement noted above if you download them from the IRS website. As we know, the IRS instructions are not authoritative. But then again, neither are transcript notations or corrections, nor are broadcasts on tax notes on Tax Talk Today. So we have a lot of unofficial guidance that's in conflict. So what is the proper treatment for self-employment for these items? Now, we have to speculate on why the IRS decided to put the clarification up, but I wouldn't be surprised to find the IRS got concerned. A number of rentals generate losses. So this would seem to say that by taking a taxpayer who had a rental property owned by a husband and wife in an LLC, if we went ahead and elected and put those on split Schedule Cs, we could then take that loss, at least to the portion of the spouse who was the one with the self-employment income otherwise, and reduce their self-employment income by the rental losses. By the way, a limitation that might not have to apply Section 469. It appears it doesn't apply Section 469 to it. So therefore, we would get to offset those rental losses. Isn't this wonderful? We could get rid of SE tax. I don't think the IRS liked that answer. Therefore, I think they wanted to get rid of that before somebody started thinking about going that way. But that raises the question of what exactly 1402A17 is meant to apply to. The new IRS view would apparently see this provision as simply saying we use the partnership rules we discussed above, whether the partnership conducted trade or business, rather than the individual rules. We don't look at whether each person would be in the trade or business. Now, that's kind of interesting because the qualified joint venture requirement is that we have to be active under the passive rules, which would seem, under most any of the interpretations, reasonable for what would be subjecting to self-employment tax for an individual who is conducting a trade or business. It would seem that if they're actively involved in the business and going beyond the minimum number of hours necessary to be active in the business, that we would in fact have somebody who is subject to self-employment tax. We would never have to mention this special restriction, but apparently the IRS wanted to make that clear. The Congress did. At least to me, this new clarification appears to be a more strained reading of A17 than the initial reading that the instructions give, which is it would bring rental real estate under SE tax. Now, on the passive activity rules, I do believe the clarification is on stronger ground, and frankly, it doesn't change what was stated in the program nor what's stated in the instructions. Section 1402A17 is clearly limited to applications in self-employment cases, would not impact 469. Now, what this does indicate is the risk of relying on unofficial IRS sources, even when the unofficial ones look official like the IRS instructions. As the tax court likes to recite, the instructions of publications are not binding rulings on the law. If the law is different, the law carries the day. And when we look at positions under the rules of Section 6694, we have to remember that we need to look at the sources the regulations tell us we can look at. All these things I just noted about the discussion on this area, except for Section 1402A17 itself, are all not authoritative. And of course, it also means a warning about IRS public representation on the use of the proposed regulations for LLC self-employment tax. The IRS has said, well, you can go ahead and use proposed regs unofficially. Of course, they said in what looked a lot more official, in instructions, that the rental real estate loss would reduce self-employment income if you made the qualified joint venture election, and now they're saying, well, no, that's not what the law says. So be aware, things change, issues occur. Now, where does that leave us? Well, if you have a qualified joint venture, I do think you have to warn your clients that it appears the IRS now is revising their view on how that impacts self-employment tax. Whether you believe that A17 really does cause rental real estate to come in is a decision you have to make relying upon the sources, doing your own analysis, and then communicate that to the client, as well as give the client the option of considering which position they want to take on the return. That is the same as what we should be doing for self-employment taxes of LLC members in general. Now, this has been the Tax Update for March the 24th, 2008. As always, the Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them for information on tax-related matters and their newsletters. Now, Arizona Society of CPAs has released their schedule of classes, and if you look in there, you'll note that in June, I'm going to be both speaking at the Financial Planning Conference for a brief presentation on computer security and what you need to worry about if you're in the financial industry as to what people can do to your computer and how they might be attacking it. And I'll also do a presentation the following week, a full-day presentation for Maris Nichols, CPE in the Arizona Society, that will be dealing with the whole ethics and tax practice matters. Our Circular 230 Our statements of standards on tax services from the AICPA and the Arizona State Accountancy Law for a 4-hour that will qualify for the ethics requirement under Arizona State law. It'll be an 8-hour course, but it'll meet your 4 hours ethics requirement as well. So if you're an Arizona Society member, you may want to take a look at that. This has been the Tax Update.